persuasions and how oftentimes we find that there is actually a degree of agreement about some issues. And one of the issues we ended up focusing on was the issue of these kind of life issues, sanctity of life issues, abortion, euthanasia, suicide, those kind of issues, moral, difficult, complex issues. And so we did kind of say that at some point we'd try and come round to it and address it. So here I am. The passage I asked Roy to read, and thank you for reading it so clearly tonight, was a passage that really is full of life, isn't it? It's a God has given this gift of life. He wants it to prosper. He wants the creatures, and that life is precious. Life is precious. Our lives are precious. Even the creatures are precious. He vows not to just destroy everything. And yet at the same time, the sort of, as we read through it, on the one hand, he's sort of getting the creatures of the earth that have come through this flood and they've survived. He's sending them out into the world to prosper. But at the same time, he's also giving them to Noah as food. So there's this kind of like interplay going on. Life is really precious, but there is also costs to sustain it in this fallen world. So anyway, I wanted that to be read, and we'll kind of come back to it. And the real key verse, I think, in it that you probably want to just have your eye on is verse 6, where after the flood, there is this reiteration or stating of a sanctity of life clause in verse 6. And this covenant is being uttered before Abraham, before Moses, so early on. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man his blood shall be shed. And then he reiterates what was said earlier in the beginning at the creation, for in the image of God has God made man. We're made in the image of God, and that's what gives us this unique dignity and preciousness. Our lives are precious. Life is precious. We are bound to God in some remarkable and unique way. And so we have to kind of take that in mind when we're thinking about the big issues that are taking place in this country at the moment and in Western Europe at the moment, in post-Protestant Europe or whatever you want to call it, about euthanasia, end of life, and abortion, women's health, and so on and so forth, which are strongly felt subjects. They are strongly argued subjects. We find ourselves in discussion with people who are coming at it from both points of view. We were just saying it's your nephew, son-in-law, is involved involved in parliamentary groups, and he is the only pro-lifer on a wider selection of people, much larger group. This is actually becoming the pro-life position in this country is becoming the minority position, and it's good to remind ourselves about what we read in Scripture, what we're taught in Scripture, try to get a practical stance on it, something that we can follow through, something we can do, if I can put it like that. See, people will say that you're unfeeling if you're not moved by natural sympathy. You know, when you see suffering in the world, you're supposed to be moved. That's the way we're made. We're empathetic creatures, aren't we? It's fellow feeling. And that's absolutely right. And so if you seem to take a stance or a position that in some way is perceived as perpetuating suffering in some way, shape, or form, you stand exposed to the accusation of being heartless, cruel, indifferent, cold, hard-hearted, and so on. Now, of course, we do know that there are some cruel, hard-hearted, indifferent, unfeeling people in the world. That happens, doesn't it? Have you noticed? But because one isn't moved, your position is not moved by those natural sympathies, doesn't always mean that you are callous and hard-hearted. It can just mean that your heart and your mind is constrained by something else, something perhaps that's more influential upon your decision making, your actions, than your emotions. That's not to diminish your emotions at all, but to say that there may be principles that hold you and grip you and make you sort of to pursue a line of action in any different situation, or an opinion or a judgment about how life should or shouldn't be lived. Now, I think when we're talking about this issue, we've got to listen to different voices, haven't we? I mean, we're hearing the voice of God, we're reading the scriptures, but in terms of the way it's all working out in the world, we know that we have to be sympathetic and listen to the people who are actually going through the experiences. Listen to the people who are caring for the people who are suffering intently. We can't afford to be dismissive about the people who are actually in the trenches, who are up close with the realities day in, day out of these experiences. We can't silence ourselves or shut out these voices. But neither would be what we be wise to shut out any voice which is the more detached, logical voice, the sort of thinking voice that has analyzed situations and looks at the data and sees the situation more objectively either. Because actually, sometimes when you're in the heart of something, what you need sometimes is somebody who's not in it, who can give you some perspective. And these two different voices need to be both heard so that you can come to a practical, workable way of going forward in life. This issue is becoming incredibly polarized, and the debate is sometimes when these debates are polarized, you lose reason, you lose clarity, because people are just so concerned about winning the argument. People will almost say, and sadly do, all sorts of things in order to win the argument, that people perhaps can lose sight of what the whole thing is all about. And I have to say, at this particular time, especially in Western Europe, maybe not so much in America, but increasingly so, God is perceived again and again as being one of the baddie actors in this whole political drama which affects so many people's lives. He's seen as cold, indifferent, unmoved, unchanging, inflexible in the situation. And that's why last week when I talked about the emotions of God, I did it deliberately, because I wanted to talk about this tonight. I wanted to make it absolutely clear that you have emotions because you've been made by a God who feels more deeply, more profoundly than we ever shall, because we've been marred by the fall. True emotion. God is the very fountain of true feeling and emotion. But that isn't to say that his emotions are not constrained or disciplined by his very nature and character, the character of love, which means that his emotions don't just get carried away with those emotions, but those emotions are deeply felt and they are applied to the world in which we live and he has created. So I'm trying to fend off accusations from anybody that we are cold and feeling, and that we have a cold and unfeeling God. I hope you feel for those who are suffering. I hope you weep with those who weep, and you laugh with those who laugh. That would be unnatural for us not to do that. This whole thing came about when we first picked up on the point that there are different religions who take what appear to be a fairly similar view to us about these pro-life issues, life issues, euthanasia. And we looked across what, let's call it, the conservative religious spectrum. And by that, I mean everything from the Muslims over here and Jews and Mormons and all sorts, the whole great collection of people who are perceived as being conservative in their opinions and their religions and so on and so forth. And it's interesting that all of them tend to cluster their beliefs and opinions around this subject in a very similar sort of way. And we are seen as Christians in the heart of that group. And I think the point I was trying to make the other night, and I hope I made it clearly enough, is that on the one hand, that's a very good thing, isn't it? Because it means that though we are few in number, Christians are few in number, our voice on these subjects is amplified by the agreement that we find with other people from other faiths and beliefs who share our beliefs and opinions. So we have common cause with them. And that, you could say, is a good thing, because we can influence society. The downside is that because we're lumped in and seen as part of that collective group, that our uniqueness and our distinctiveness gets lost. We just get lumped in together as that lot who keep saying no. And really, people's capacity to distinguish between fundamental Christians, fundamentalist Christians, or fundamentalist Muslims, or fundamentally, you're all just fundamentalists, and to be honest with you, you're just a bad lot. And we talked this morning about Christianity has something offensive to say. The cross is offensive. The cross is offensive. But that really is where the offense needs to be. That is the offense of Christianity, not our conduct, as we were talking about this morning, or our politics, if you like, either. Somehow the thing that has to be offensive about us is our gospel. If there's going to be some stumbling, it's going to be that. That needs to be that. And we need to remove every other obstacle from people's path so they can say, the only reason I don't believe what you're saying is because I have accepted the fact, having heard from you, is that actually I love my sin, I hate God, and I want to go to hell, as it were. Do you know that they've actually made it, that there's no other offense that you've caused them. They're not saying, I don't believe your gospel because you said this or you did that, or because it's just the gospel they're reacting or responding to, and they know exactly what they're doing. That's what we want to leave people in that place of thinking, so they know where they stand. They know where they stand. It concerns me that we get put in a whole catchment with a group of other people who actually, truthfully, our message is so radically different from what they're sharing. Though it appears we use the same words like God and even Jesus and heaven and all these sort of things that appear to be, there's such a group of similarities, that the danger is people will not realize that we have something fundamentally different to say about the means of salvation and where we're going and what life is actually all about. So that's my concern, that although we have this broad agreement, it seems, on pro-life issues, it does also bunch us in with a group of people whose actual beliefs and ours are so radically different. And I think that's a problem. And I think we have to think wisely about what tack we take. And there is also a wide agreement, isn't there, amongst those who you might say have liberal perspectives, liberal religious perspectives and so on. And they are pointing the finger at us. And they're saying, can't you see the suffering? Can't you see what these people are going through? Can't you, if you are Christians, can't you be just a little bit charitable? I thought this was the religion of love. Where's the charity? Where is the charity? It's a very difficult horn that we found ourselves on. Let's just say something about this agreement that exists with people of other, effectively, of other faiths. I went to hear a lecture the other day by a man called Peter Law on the three great Abrahamic faiths, and he mentioned, I'm just going to rattle through this very, very quickly. It just might be interesting, maybe it's not. But I hope it will be, obviously. How it is that we have this agreement or apparent agreement. And he pointed very rightly to things like Romans chapter 1 that tells us the whole earth knows there's a God. The creation declares it. There's nobody's with an excuse. So we shouldn't be entirely surprised that people all around the world in some sense have a sense of this divinity, the presence of divinity in the world. And so therefore that should arrest them, make them think about life and its meaning and so on and so forth. And so secondly, that we uniquely are made, human beings are made in the image of God. And therefore there's something about being a human being that connects us to the very deity that we can observe in this world. And we know there's something extraordinary out there. There's this presence in the world, and that somehow, somewhere we've been made in such a way to have fellowship with this God. And that our lives, even though they might be quite dreary in lots of practical ways, there's something extraordinary about being a human being, the experience of being a human being. Something precious. We have been set apart in some way in the universe for a unique purpose. And maybe people don't understand what that is, but there's something special about being a person. Life is precious. Our human life is precious. And thirdly, there's the fact that, you know, having all derived from the same roots and origins in Adam, surely the things that he received from God directly, they have, though many people have dismissed it and gone their own ways, and different tribes and tongues and nations have gone around the world with their own religions, you cannot but believe that there is some remnant of those first things that he learned transmitted through the various generations. You wouldn't be surprised if we're all derived from the same root. There should be similarities around the world, even though the religions might be quite different. It may be distorted, but there should be some similarities. And God in his mercy, you think after the fall, really everything could have just come to a grinding standstill and instant judgment. But God has been so patient out of his love with the world. There are good laws. He puts good laws in reason and rationale into people's minds to restrain evil and to promote the good. And all these things all tend to have value on life. They're all putting a value on life. And the scriptures have been circulated round the world, and therefore we wouldn't be at all surprised at the fact that there's an influence from Christian teaching and Jewish theology that came from the Old Testament that circulated into the Middle East and then out to the Far East. And it's, you know, the Word of God has gone to the four corners of the earth, so we shouldn't be surprised to find remnants of it being expressed in people's beliefs. But there is also the final thing that I think we need to be cautious about, is that the devil presents himself as an angel of light. That all these similarities, in one sense, should be heartening to us, but also we mustn't forget the fact that at the same time, that similarity could be a cause of stumbling. Somebody could believe something, oh, look, you're all the same, and actually be severely misled into something. And we've got to somehow try to guard people against the danger of seeing this general agreement as being more than it actually is, more than it actually is. What makes us different? What makes us different? And how does that affect our views on these things? What's the real difference? What do you find in this book, in our New Testament? What do we find preached and taught that is so different? Essentially, it all revolves about one person, doesn't it? Who is this man? Isn't it? It's him, isn't it? That's the thing that sets it apart. Not just who is he? What has he done? Why did he do it? And what has been accomplished by, what has he done? When he said it is finished, what's been finished? What has happened now? The absolutely unmerited free grace of God has just been poured out on wretched sinners, free of charge, without complaint, lovingly bestowed by a father as to his own children. It's just, nobody in the world has got a message like this. Everything else is working your way, climbing the hill, trying to prove or earn the love of God by your efforts and your good works and all the rest of it. And people might nuance there the way they present it in different ways and have different names, but in the end, irreducibly, that is the difference. You're not trying to earn the love of God. I hope nobody in this room is trying to earn the love of God. It's yours. It's yours. And what we do is we just respond to it, don't we? We respond to the love of God. That's so precious. Life is so precious, isn't it? Life is so precious. I hope the moment you believed, the preciousness of life was underlined to you 1,000 times. By the love of God that's poured abroad in your hearts. And that Christians amongst all people should know that even a wretched, apparently useless, worthless, sinful, broken piece of humanity that has no use necessarily or purpose, or it seems it's totally broken, apparently beyond repair, the fact that God would bestow upon himself the very blood of his own son to save and redeem should tell us life is so precious. We should have a joy in life, a care for life, that perhaps should be shine brightly above all the others. It's not just a moralism, moral persuasion. It's just it's an experience. Again, you know, you've got your coffee morning coming up. You know, again, all this work you've done in Bulgaria. Every time you've gone, it's always been impressed upon me the same time. Here are people who are incapable of really offering very much, and how much it is the love of God to just go and lavish yourself on those who can give you nothing. That's really what he's done, isn't it? What can we give God? His delight is to give to us. And so there is life that is hurting in this world. There are people who are hurting in this world. People who are in really difficult situations in this world who can't give us anything. And I suppose Christians always have and remain to be deeply moved and concerned about the welfare of such people, and people on the edges, people in difficulties, people in pain, the orphans, the widows, the fatherless, the hungry, the voiceless, the weak. And I think historically it can be traced, you know, education, health services, general health, all these things have been produced by a response to the gospel. You see, our faith is not just at root a moral faith. It's not just about doing good. It's about experiencing the good of God, which produces good fruit in us. It produces a response and a result in us. It's so different. It's so different to be a community governed by free grace and the love of God. And so when we're thinking about euthanasia, when we're thinking about abortion or something like that, we cannot do it and detach ourselves from the gospel that's ours. We can't look at these issues as separate from us and just draw on the moral positions of all these other points of view. How can we help people in these situations? How can we help the people who are in agonizing pain? How can we help the people who don't know where to turn or how they'll look after their children? Or don't know how these decisions and accidents and mistakes they've made will be worked out in their life? What can we do? Jesus challenged us, didn't he? Whatever you do for the least of these, don't you do it for me. Somehow the love of God has to be worked out in practice, doesn't it? We can't just talk about it. We have to make a difference. And when we're talking about these beginning of life, end of life issues, the truth is we find ourselves often in these kind of least of two evil situations, which are the hardest ones to crack, aren't they? You know, dear Solomon, he becomes king, he gets this dream that he's going to be given this, he asked for wisdom to govern his people. And if you read it through in the passage in Chronicles, it seems like the first morning after, suddenly these two women appear, both arguing and saying that this baby belongs to me. You know the story. You know, his first day on the job. You know, this almost impossible situation. And we need the wisdom of Solomon, because whatever the decision is going to be, somebody's going to be left hurting. Somebody. It's going to be painful. And it's trying to work out what is the best way to approach the situation. Because the truth is, I wish we could all say that suffering was preventable in the world. Wouldn't it be great to be able to go out into the world? Somebody was telling me a report from a church they'd been to, and honestly, they were trusting and believing God for this person who's had their leg amputated, and they were going to trust and believe God that this leg would grow back. I'm not sure. You know, somebody else was telling me about a family, young woman was killed at a prayer meeting to trust God that she'd be raised from the dead. Well, I actually think really right there and then, I think you should be just praying for the family and getting around there and doing everything you can to help a family through one of the worst experiences imaginable. Not rather than sort of raising people's, you know, come on, we can see the difference, can't we? You can see the difference between what is faith and some kind of manipulation. We've got to help. And there's suffering in this world. It's part of the world. And Christians, you know, when the plague broke out in London, lots of people left the city. It's amazing that in the 1600s there are reports of Christians coming into the city. They had plagues in the Roman Empire. Christians would go into the plague areas. helped. They made a difference. And there is suffering in the world, and we have to find a way every single time. How do we minimize that suffering? How can we work out the best solution to this problem with minimizing it? And minimizing it isn't always the answer, sadly, because there are very unethical ways of minimizing suffering too. You've got to find an ethical way of doing it, a good way of doing it, and balancing all these things out. And when you look around at our country at the moment, that's trying to work out what it believes. I mean, I don't know what you think generally our nation is, but when you look at its laws, you can see something about what it really believes. What does Britain believe about the sanctity of life? How precious is life in the mind and consciousness of this country? And you look at its laws, and that's the embodiment of its beliefs, really, isn't it? You know, what it practices, what it does. And at the moment, if you look at the laws, and we can compare it about Christian practice in a minute, in these post-Protestant countries of the West, abortion is legal. Yes? Isn't it? Legal. And you need two doctors to sign to authorize the termination of the pregnancy. I kind of sometimes think about this and sometimes I don't, and because I've been preparing for this, it just hit me again. I think I'm right in saying that the termination of pregnancies is lawful up to 28 weeks. I think it's 24. It's up to 28? Is it up to 28 or it's changed to 24? Up or down? If it's 28, we're talking 7 months. If it's 24, we're just talking 6 months. Come on. And last year, 200,000. 200,000. Polled by the Times, 75% of the British population believe that abortion should be legal. And interestingly, there was about 20% of people who thought it should be mostly legal. And by that, I think they were trying to say that, you know, I don't think in every case, I think there should be more tighter controls. There are some people who are voicing concern, I suppose what I'm saying is that somehow it's just, because the truth is, right now it is abortion on demand, isn't it? The very fact that you walk into a surgery and you talk to somebody and say, I want a termination, that is enough evidence that there is a cause that this pregnancy, this child would, for whatever reason, and they don't press the buttons and they don't ask the questions because the moral questions are so complex, that that's enough for them, and they will go ahead and they will authorize. And it's only about 4% of the British population that believe that all abortions should be absolutely illegal in every circumstance, and then the rest kind of believe that it broadly should be illegal, but there might be exceptions. So these are the days when this is absolutely prevalent. It's absolutely prevalent. You look at the other end of life, and very few of these nations that we're looking at today allow assisted suicide or voluntary euthanasia. Euthanasia is basically not broadly widely accepted, but it's changing, isn't it? Yes? Court case after court case after court case, and new legislation being considered in Parliament. We talked about motor neurone disease the other day, and that has been one of the causes of, it's been championed as one of the reasons why the right to die case should be heard and accepted and legally changed. Holland, everybody says, oh, they have euthanasia in Holland. Quite interesting. I didn't realize it's actually still culpable homicide in Holland, but they've made a decision not to prosecute, provided that the doctors involved have got certain legal qualifications and so on and so forth. But in Holland, in 2010, I didn't have any more recent figures, 4,000 people's, the end of life, their lives were terminated at the end of their lives. compared to the abortion statistics, it's still a very small number, isn't it? But it's pretty significant. And the fact is, in this country, when polled, up to 46% of doctors recommend that euthanasia should be lawful. So if a change was authorized, we would certainly see those figures creeping up pretty fast, you would think. Let's be clear. I think the big difference is that a child has absolutely no right or say about what happens to them. Whereas all the euthanasia issues, this is a voluntary issue where people are actually voicing for themselves what they want about their own lives. There are lots of moral questions that surround it. Is it because they're fearful at the end of life, in the midst of a disease? Is that the best time to make a decision like that? Or other people who make that decision way ahead of the event and they put it down in writing in their will, that's what they want to happen. But what do they really know about the end of life at a stage like that? They're just perhaps speaking out of fear, whatever. But the fact is, you know, at the moment, thankfully, nobody's talking about involuntary euthanasia, which is putting people to sleep whether they want to or not, and putting people down whether they want to or not. And that's the sort of thing that was trialed out in Germany in the last century, wasn't it? And thousands and thousands and thousands of people, whether they wanted to or not, were felt to be socially inconvenient and a burden on the state, and that was a political expedient. And nobody wants to find themselves there again. It's kind of weird, isn't it? Because no country permits murder. No country allows you to go and take somebody else's life. And yet these statistics are absolutely horrifying, aren't they? Horrifying statistics. Having said that, it's all about the will, isn't it? If you come to suicide, so it used to be illegal to attempt to commit suicide, didn't it? It's not illegal anymore. It's been decriminalized. If you choose to take your own life, nobody's going to prosecute you for that. If you're caught attempting to do so, you're not going to be prosecuted for that. You're going to get some support and some help. It's not illegal. This country, 6,000 people took their life in 2012. People taking their own lives. For whatever reason, in those circumstances, they do not value life as being worth living. And those abortion statistics, they are saying that the value of life, there is no value to those lives. It's interesting that, having said all that, that we still send troops into battle to put their lives on the line. 4,000 service people have been killed since the last war, and I don't know how I'd even begin to calculate the number of people we've authorized those service personnel, how many lives to take in the course of the pursuit of their duties. But these things continue in the world, don't they? Genesis 9, ironically, as we've just been saying, although on the one hand it says whoever sheds the blood of a man, is there such a concern? We're made in the image of God, chapter 9 verse 6, we're made in the image of God, there's such a sanctity and preciousness of life. But in the same verse it says by man shall his blood be shed. So at the same time we're saying that life is so precious, if you take life, quite clearly there, this passage also authorizes capital punishment, doesn't it? So these two things to balance out. Capital punishment to show that the sin of taking life is heinous and hated. And people who do it should be prevented from doing so again. And that justice must be done. That's what we see. That's what we see in those verses. And right across the conservative religious world, you'll see that these views are broadly agreed upon. Genesis chapter 9, the sanctity of life. I don't know what you think, but I think the real thing that we have to make our priority, if we put it like this, what should we make our prayers, what should we speak out about? I think abortion is the issue. I think abortion is the number one issue, the priority issue. Because we have a responsibility, don't we? We have a responsibility to speak for those who can't speak for themselves, to act for those who can't act for themselves, to protect the weak and the young. Now, I'm not saying that this isn't complicated. And people have all these different points of view. I don't know if you heard all the points. When does life start? When does life start? People talk about all the biology and the science of it all, and there's so many different points of view. Is it at 14 days? Some people are saying, or when implantation, when the egg, the subfertilized egg actually connects to the uterus, in which case the coil becomes a form of abortion rather than contraception, or when the fetus begins to quicken, or when a life is viable. In other words, if the child was born at that stage, it could survive with medical help and support. Or is a child only really alive when it's born? Some people believe that that's the case. Or when the heart begins to beat. Or when are you going to put, where are you going to draw the line? When is it a life, a life? For myself, I think it's the moment of conception. And that may be a very inconvenient conclusion to draw, but I think that's the truth. I think from that moment, there is a life there. There is a life there. I'm not ready to go with the Catholics to say that the moment you intend to create a child, or, you know, that all procreation has to be for that purpose alone, and you don't get involved in anything. There's no contraception. I think that's nonsense. But I think that moment, there's a life there, isn't there? There's a life. There's a new life. Okay. So I would say lives are being taken. People who have no right, their lives are being taken in large numbers. In large numbers. So if we went to Romans chapter 13, if you don't have to turn there if you didn't want to, but in Romans 13 we have very clear instructions how Christians should conduct themselves in society. And the fact is that the lawmakers, chapter 13, have rights. They have rights under God. Everybody must submit themselves to the governing authorities. There's no authority except for what God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, he who rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted. I think it's not saying, by the way, that it means that every government you have to support it as if it was, you know, the will of God in that sense. The fact that government exists is God's gift to humanity. There is still bad government. And those who do so will bring judgment on themselves. Rulers hold no terror for those who do right, and so on and so forth. It's talking about the importance of good government. Now, in America and some places in the world, people have said murders have been committed and they have become vigilantes. You've heard about the stories, firebombing the abortion clinics, shooting practitioners, abortion practitioners, and so on and so forth. They become vigilantes. I would say that is an out-and-out contravention of what we read here, personally. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't play our part. If we see something that is taking place in our country and we have a part to play in the formation of opinions and politics in this country, that we should sit on the fence and do nothing and say nothing, we should be exerting ourselves in every way, shape, or form. And, thankfully, most of these things don't sort of, they're not being imposed upon us, but if these things were imposed upon us, we would have to act according to our consciences. We would have to rebel, in that sense, against false laws. You know, it's called civil disobedience. There are ways of doing that, aren't there? The fact is, when you look back at what happened in Germany, when all these things were just got completely out of hand, the church, in the main, did nothing, said nothing, was quiet, and became acquiescent to the whole thing, and has had to be repenting and saying sorry ever since. But it's too late. So we can't just be quiet about it. I think this issue of abortion is the number one issue. And perhaps all the civilians who are dying as a consequence of the wars which we are authorizing. And we have to do everything in our power, don't we, to make sure that the combatants that we're fighting are the people that we're fighting, and that all damage to other people is kept to an absolute minority, a minimum. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, which we read this morning, verse 12, says, whose job ultimately is it to judge? Actually, we just have to judge ourselves, and we have to do what's right. It's not our position to judge other people. People will do what they will do. And the fact that they carry on doing it does not mean that that's what we should do either. And we have to model our distinctives. And we have to make sure we lift up our voices. Lift up our voices. It's wrong. It's wrong. You know, the world's views on sexual morality, on abstinence and marriage and living in community and all these things are changing, radically changing. And the gospel is calling us to these things, to live these kind of lives, because these bring honor to Christ, who's come amongst us and given himself so fully for us. And I really believe the best thing, I know this is going to sound like Ben just harping on the same old thing I always got. I think the best thing we can do in this situation, in the communities we're living in, is to preach Christ. Because although we can bang the drum along with other people who are banging the same drum about abortion and all the rest of it, and that's right, and there is a time and a place for, but I have to say that the voice that we have to make clearest, the message we have to make most clear above it all, that is distinct and unique from everything else, is Jesus Christ, who invests a person with forgiveness for all of their past sins, and we have all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, and gives us a hope for the future and strength to live and a community in which to live and the framework and fabric in which to do the very best that we can. We've got to make the voice of Christ. I'm saying, I really believe that if we want to address the issues like the mass, because the truth is that now that in so many ways this whole abortion, it's become a new form of contraception. And the callousness that's being ingrained into the psyche and the minds of so many people. It's so devastating. And it would be all too easy to spend oneself, and I'd understand it if people did, on this single issue and crying out on this single issue. But I think if we just cry out all the louder for Jesus and call people to Jesus, that is probably the greatest prevention that we can do. Because we know that if people come to Christ, if they come to faith, when they come to faith, a radical change takes place in their hearts and their lives. And their attitude to life changes. And when they find themselves in the painful, difficult, compromising, agonizing situations of life, because let's face it, you don't become an exception to that just because you've just become a Christian. You face it with a grace and a perspective that is completely unique and different to everybody else. And we give witness and glory to God in the decisions we make, sometimes the really hard decisions that we make, that we do in faith, trusting Christ, who strengthens us and enables us to live a very different kind of life. What can we do for the unborn children who are in desperate danger today? Preach Christ. I believe that. You know, some people would want a kind of whole-scale moralistic ban across the country in our laws. But we know where that's ended. It hasn't solved the problem. It will not ultimately solve the problem. I personally, as far as politics are concerned, I would like to see stricter controls, much stricter controls. And I would like to see just it being a discretionary thing, just like the way we approach every, because lives do get lost in this world. We have wars, people die, things happen, people at the end of their life, and I thank God for doctors who at the end of their life are committed to making sure that people are, as they put it, comfortable at the end of their lives. And I've seen people administering palliative care at the end of their lives and doing an absolutely outstanding, remarkable work, helping people in the painful, difficult course of the end of their lives. And yes, there is a point at which the treatment overtakes the care and they go. And doctors are really, yes, we have to, there's the shipman factor, but they are essentially the best trained people to preside over such things and make these decisions, and they do it very well. It should be a matter of great care and discretion and so on. But you know, honestly, people in this abortion debate, they're starting to say things like this. They're trying to, if a woman has had an abortion and then she says, I regret it. It was a difficult choice. It was a painful ethical decision, but I had to do it, and so on and so forth. These women are being lambasted as giving some credibility to the idea that an abortion could ever be a wrong thing to do. They're kind of putting up a position that abortion is always the right to, because it's not a life. It's not a life. And the only way they can justify the whole matter to themselves is convincing everybody and themselves that they are not committing. This isn't a difficult decision. There's no ethical or moral problems about this at all. It isn't a life. And as soon as you say a life is not a life, and then you import that into everything else and your views about the world, it's a spiritual cancer, isn't it? It's a spiritual cancer. It's interesting, in Exodus chapter, nearly finished, Exodus chapter 21, verses 22 to 23, there's an incident recorded where a fight breaks out. And there's a couple of chaps slugging it out in amongst the tents of Israel. 21, verses 22 and 23. And it's recorded. If men who are fighting hit a pregnant woman and she gives birth prematurely, but there's no serious injury, the offender must be fined whatever the woman's husband demands and the court allows. But if there is a serious injury, you are to take life for life. I tell you why that's important, because there in the scriptures you can see that unborn child is treated as a life. It's a life. It doesn't say at the beginning of its life, at the beginning of the pregnancy, at the end of the pregnancy, at 14 days, or it's a life. It's a life. And it's precious to God. Isaiah said that he was called by God to his ministry while he was still in the womb. Jeremiah said it. I was called in the womb. The Apostle Paul believed he was called in the womb. John the Baptist recognized Jesus in the womb. And in Psalm 139, you have that beautiful description of us being fearfully and wonderfully made, knitted together in the womb by God. God's love and care and attention on an unborn child. We have a responsibility to protect the fatherless and the orphans and the weak and the voiceless. We have to help people who are in these difficult moral situations. And in the end, the very best help we can, if we can win people to Christ and help them in their practical situations, it's the best thing that we could ever do. And there has to be good provisions, doesn't there, in our society to look after children who are not wanted or can't be looked after. There has to be help for women who really need support and are in very vulnerable positions. And it has to be proper, serious support, not a token, if we're serious about these sort of things. Right now, I'm concerned, you know, with all the embryonic stem cell research developments, that now this mass availability of raw material is just being preyed upon by an industry. In the pharmaceuticals, the massive pharmaceutical industry, and the potential for the exploitation of this situation is absolutely grotesque. It's absolutely grotesque. We need to make sure there's proper help for people who are dying. I thank God for some of the hospices and people who work in the hospices. Some of them are doing an absolutely amazing work, and they need all the support and the prayers that we can offer them. We need to do the best we can when people are suffering, to get alongside them, to speak to them, to encourage them, to pray for them, and so on and so forth. And the pregnant women and the orphans and the people in pain. Life is worth living. All of it. All of it. Even the very worst of it. Because we are made in the image of God. And I hope none of us are tested and put into the way. But it's part of Jesus' encouragement to us, you know, to pray, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. That we should not be in such a state where we despair of these things. May the Lord protect each one of us. But when we find ourselves in these places, or there's others in those places, that we would be there for them. and help them and encourage them and pray for them and do all we can. Jesus died for sinners. He died for sinners. He gave himself. Well, that tells us everything we need to know about what we need to do. Difficult subject, and I'm sure there's lots of experiences in this very room.